The shore end of the cable runs into a new reinforced concrete building, set back about 100 meters from the high tide level. It is basically just a big room filled with batteries, generators, air conditioning units, and racks of electronic equipment. The software running on that equipment is Randy's responsibility. And so he spends most of his time in that building, staring into a computer screen and typing. From there, transmission lines run up the hill to the microwave tower. The other end is being extended out towards a buoy that is bobbing in the South China Sea a few kilometers away. Attached to that buoy is the end of the North Luzon Coastal Festoon, a cable owned by Philatel that runs up the coast of the island. If you follow it far enough, you reach a building at the northern tip of the island where a big cable from Taiwan comes in. Taiwan, in turn, is heavily webbed into the world submarine cable network. It is easy and cheap to get data into or out of Taiwan. There is only one gap left in the private chain of transmission that Epiphyte and Philatel are trying to establish from Taiwan to downtown Manila, and that gap gets narrower by the day as the cable barge grinds its way towards the buoy. When it finally gets there, Rui Falero weighs anchor and glides out to meet it. The helicopter and the speedboat and a flotilla of hired boats go into action, ferrying dignitaries and media crews out of Manila. Avi shows up carrying 2 fresh tuxedos from a tailor shop in Shanghai. All those famous Hong Kong tailors were refugees from Shanghai. He and Randy tear off the tissue paper, put them on, and then ride in an unair-conditioned jeepney down the hill to the dock where Gloria awaits them. 2 hours later, Randy gets to lay eyes on the dentist and the diva for the first time ever, in the grand ballroom of the Rui Falero. To Randy, the party is like any other. He shakes hands with a few people, forgets their names, finds a place to sit down, and enjoys the wine and the food in blissful solitude. The one thing that is special about this party is that 2 tar-covered cables, each about the thickness of a baseball bat, are running up onto the quarterdeck. If you go to the rail and look down, you can see them disappear into the brine. The cable ends meet on a tabletop in the middle of the deck, where a technician, flown in from Hong Kong and dutied up in a tuxedo, sits with a box of tools working on the splice. He is also working on a big hangover, but that is fine with Randy, since he knows that it's all fake. The cables are just scraps, their loose ends trailing in the water alongside the yacht. The real splice was performed yesterday and is already lying on the bottom of the sea with bits running through it. There is another man on the quarterdeck, mostly staring at Batan and Corregidor, but also keeping an eye on Randy. The moment Randy notices him, this man nods, as if checking something off a list in his head, stands up, walks over, and joins him. He is wearing a very ornate uniform, the U.S. Navy equivalent of black tie. He is mostly bald, and what hair he does have is battleship gray and shorn to a length of perhaps 5 millimeters. As he walks toward Randy, several Filipinos watch him with obvious curiosity. "Randy," he says. Metals clink together as he grips Randy's right hand and shakes it. He looks to be around 50, but he has the skin of an 80-year-old Bedouin. He has a lot of ribbons on his chest, and many of them are red and yellow, which are colors that Randy vaguely associates with Vietnam. Above his pocket is a little plastic nameplate reading Shafto.
"Don't be deceived, Randy," says Douglas MacArthur Shafto. "I'm not on active duty. Retired eons ago. But I'm still entitled to wear this uniform, and it's a hell of a lot easier than going out and trying to find a tuxedo that fits me."
"Pleased to meet you."
"Pleasure's mine. Where'd you get yours, by the way?"
"My tuxedo?"
"Yeah."
My partner had it made."
"Your business partner or your sexual partner?"
"Oh, my business partner. At the moment, I am without a sexual partner." Doug Shafto nods impassively.
"It is telling that you have not obtained one in Manila, as our host did, for example."
Randy looks into the ballroom at Victoria Vigo, who, if she were any more radiant,
would cause paint to peel from the walls and window panes to sag like caramel.
I guess I'm just shy or something, Randy says.
Are you too shy to listen to a business proposition?
Not at all.
My daughter asserts that you and our host might lay some more cables around here in coming years.
Well, in business, people rarely plan to do a thing only once, Randy says. It messes up the spreadsheets.
You are aware by now that the water in this area is shallow.
Yeah.
You know that cables cannot be laid in shallow water without extremely detailed, high-resolution side-scan sonar surveys.
Yes.
I would like to perform those surveys for you, Randy.
I see.
No, I don't think you do see. But I want you to see, and so I'm going to explain it.
Okay, Randy says. Should I bring my partner out?
The concept I am about to convey to you is very simple and does not require two first-rate minds in order to process it,
Doug Shafto says.
Okay. What is the concept?
The detailed survey will be just chock-full of new information about what is on the floor of the ocean in this part of the world. Some of that information might be valuable. More valuable than you imagine.
Ah, Randy says. You mean that it might be the kind of thing that your company knows how to capitalize on?
That's right,
says Doug Shafto.
Now, if you hire one of my competitors to perform your survey and they stumble on this kind of information, they will not tell you about it. They will exploit it themselves. You will not know that they have found anything, and you will not profit from it. But if you hire Semper Marine Services, I will tell you about whatever I find, and I will cut you and your company in on a share of any proceeds.
Randy says. He is trying to figure out how to do a poker face, but he knows that Shafto sees right through him.
On one condition,
Doug Shafto says.
I suspected there might be a condition.
Every hook that's worth a damn has a barb. This is the barb.
What is it?
Randy asks.
We keep it a secret from that son of a bitch,
Doug Shafto says, jerking his thumb at Hubert Kepler.
Because if the dentist finds out, then he and the Bolobolos will just split the entire thing up between them and we'll see nothing. There's even a chance we would end up dead.
Well, the being dead part is something that we will certainly have to think about, Randy says. But I will convey your proposal to my partner.
Tube. Waterhouse and a few dozen strangers are standing and sitting in an extraordinarily long, narrow room that rocks from side to side. The room is lined with windows, but no light comes into them, only sound. A great deal of rumbling, rattling, and screeching. Everyone is pensive and silent, as if they were sitting in church, waiting for the service to kick off. Waterhouse is standing up, gripping a ceiling-mounted protuberance that keeps him from being rocked right onto his can. For the last couple of minutes, he has been staring at a nearby poster providing instructions on how to put on a gas mask. Waterhouse, like everyone else, is carrying one such device with him in a small dun canvas shoulder bag. Waterhouse's looks different from everyone else's because it is American and military. It has drawn a stare or two from the others. On the poster is a lovely and stylish woman with white skin and auburn hair, which appears to have been chemically melted and reset into its current shape at a quality salon. She stands upright, her spine like a flagpole, chin in the air, elbows bent, hands ritualistically posed, fingers splayed, thumbs sticking straight up in the air just in front of her face. A sinister lump dangles between her hands, held in a cat's cradle of khaki strapping. Her upthrust thumbs are the linchpins of this tidy web. Waterhouse has been in London for a couple of days now, and so he knows the next part of the story. He would know this pose anywhere. This woman is poised for the chin thrust. If gas ever falls on the Capitol, the gas rattles will sound and the tops of the massive mailboxes, which have all been treated with special paint, will turn black. 20 million thumbs will point into the greenish poison sky. 10 million gas masks will dangle from them. 10 million chins will thrust. He can just imagine the crisp, luscious sound of this woman's soft white skin forcing itself into the confining black rubber.
Once the chin thrust is complete, all is well. You have to get the straps neatly arranged atop your auburn permanent and get indoors, but the worst danger is past. The British gas masks have a squat round fitting on the front to allow exhalation, which looks exactly like the snout of a pig, and no woman would be caught dead in such a thing if the models in the gas mask posters were not such paragons of high-caste beauty. Something catches his eye out in the darkness beyond the window. The train has reached one of those parts of the underground where dim gun-barrel-colored light sifts down, betraying the Stygian secrets of the tube. Everyone in the car blinks, glances, and draws breath. The world has rematerialized around them for a moment. Fragments of wall, encrusted trusses, bundles of cable hang in space out there, revolving slowly like astronomical bodies as the train works its way past. The cables catch Waterhouse's eye, neatly bracketed to the stone walls in parallel courses. They are like the creepers of some plutonic ivy that spreads through the darkness of the tube when the maintenance men aren't paying attention, seeking a place to break out and up into the light. When you walk along the street, up there in the overground, you see the first tendrils making their way up the ancient walls of the buildings. Neoprene-jacketed vines that grow in straight lines up sheer stone and masonry and inject themselves through holes in window frames, homing in particularly on offices. Sometimes they are sheathed in metal tubes. Sometimes the owners have painted them over. But all of them share a common root system that flourishes in the unused channels and crevices of the underground, converging on giant switching stations and deep bomb-proof vaults. The train invades a cathedral of dingy yellow light and groans to a stop, hugging the aisle. Lurid icons of national paranoia glow in the niches and grottos. An angelic, chin-thrusting woman anchors one end of the moral continuum. At the opposite, we have a succubus in a tight skirt, sprawled on a davenport in the midst of a party, smirking through her false eyelashes as she eavesdrops on the naive young serviceman gabbing away behind her. Signs on the wall identify this as Euston, in a tasteful sans-serif that screams official credibility. Waterhouse and most of the other people get off the train. After 15 minutes or so of ricocheting around the station's precincts, asking directions and puzzling out timetables, Waterhouse finds himself sitting aboard an intercity train bound for Birmingham. Along the way, it is promised, it will stop at a place called Bletchley. Part of the reason for the confusion is that there is another train about to leave from an adjacent siding, which goes straight to Bletchley, its final destination, with no stops in between. Everyone on that train, it seems, is a female in a quasi-military uniform. The RAF men with the Sten guns, standing watch by each door of that train, checking papers and passes, will not let him aboard. Waterhouse looks through the yellowing influence of the windows at the Bletchley girls in the train, facing each other in clatches of four and five, getting their knitting out of their bags, turning balls of Scottish wool into balaclavas and mittens for convoy crews in the North Atlantic, writing letters to their brothers in the service and their mums and dads at home. The RAF gunmen remain by the doors until all of them are closed and the train has begun to move out of the station. As it builds speed, the rows and rows of girls, knitting and writing and chatting, blur together into something that probably looks a good deal like what sailors and soldiers the world over are commonly seeing in their dreams. Waterhouse will never be one of those soldiers out on the front line, out in contact with the enemy. He has tasted the apple of forbidden knowledge. He is forbidden to go anywhere in the world where he might be captured by the enemy. The train climbs up out of the night and into a red brick arroyo, headed northwards out of the city. It is about 3 in the afternoon. That special BP train must have been carrying swing shift gals. Waterhouse has the feeling he will not be working anything like a regular shift. His duffel bag, which was packed for him, is pregnant with sartorial possibilities. Thick oiled wool sweaters, tropical weight Navy and Army uniforms, black ski mask, condoms. The train slowly pulls free of the city, and passes into a territory patched with small residential towns. Waterhouse feels heavy in his seat and suspects a slight uphill tendency. They pass through a cleft that has been made across a low range of hills, like a kerf in the top of a log, and enter into a lovely territory of subtly swelling emerald green fields, strewn randomly with small white capsules that he takes to be sheep. Of course, their distribution is probably not random at all. It probably reflects local variations in soil chemistry, producing grass that the sheep find more or less desirable. From aerial reconnaissance, the Germans could draw up a map of British soil chemistry based upon analysis of sheep distribution. The fields are enclosed by old hedges, stone fences, or especially in the uplands, long swaths of forest. After an hour or so, the forest comes right up along the left side of the train, covering a bank that rises up gently from the railway siding. The train's brakes come on gassily, and the train grumbles to a stop in a whistle-stop station. But the line has forked and ramified quite a bit, more than is warranted by the size of the station. Waterhouse stands, plants his feet squarely, squats down in a sumo wrestler stance, and engages his duffel bag. Duffel appears to be winning as it seemingly pushes Waterhouse out the door of the train and onto the platform. There is a stronger-than-usual smell of coal and a good deal of noise coming from not far away. Waterhouse looks up the line and discovers a heavy industrial works unfurled across the many sidings. He stands and stares for a couple of minutes as his train pulls away, headed for points north, and sees that they are in the business of repairing steam locomotives here at Bletchley Depot. Waterhouse likes trains. But that is not why he got a free suit of clothes and a ticket to Bletchley, and so once again Waterhouse engages Duffel and gets it up the stairs to the enclosed bridge that flies over all of the parallel lines. Looking toward the station, he sees more Bletchley girls, WAFs and Wrens, coming towards him. The day shift, finished with their work, which consists of the processing of ostensibly random letters and digits on a heavy industrial scale. Not wanting to appear ridiculous in their sight, he finally gets Duffel maneuvered onto his back, gets his arms through the shoulder straps, and allows its weight to throw him forward across the bridge. The WAFs and Wrens are only moderately interested in the sight of a newly arriving American officer, or perhaps they are only being demure. In any case, Waterhouse knows he is one of the few, but not the first. Duffel shoves him through the one-room station like a fat cop chivying a hammerlocked drunk across the lobby of a two-star hotel. Waterhouse is ejected into a strip of open territory running along the north-south road. Directly across from him, the woods rise up. Any notion that they might be woods of the inviting sort is quickly dissolved by a dense spray of gelid light glinting from the border of the wood as the low sun betrays that the place is saturated with sharpened metal. There is an orifice in the woods, spewing WAFs and Wrens like the narrow outlet of a giant yellowjacket nest. Waterhouse must either move forward or be pulled onto his back by Duffel and left squirming helplessly in the parking lot like a flipped beetle. So he staggers forward, across the street and onto the wide footpath, into the woods. The Bletchley girls surround him. They have celebrated the end of their shift by applying lipstick. Wartime lipstick is necessarily cobbled together from whatever tailings and gristle were left over once all of the good stuff was used to coat propeller shafts. A florid and cloying scent is needed to conceal its unspeakable mineral and animal origins. It is the smell of war. Waterhouse has not even been given the full tour of BP yet, but he knows the gist of it. He knows that these demure girls, obediently shuffling reams of gibberish through their machines, shift after shift, day after day, have killed more men than Napoleon. He makes slow and apologetic progress against the tide of the departing day shift. At one point, he simply gives up, steps aside, body slams Duffel into the ivy, lights up a cigarette, and waits for a burst of 100 or so girls to go by him. Something pokes at his ankle. A wild raspberry cane, furious with thorns. It supports an uncannily small and tidy spider web, whose geodesic strands gleam in a beam of low afternoon light. The spider in the center is an imperturbable British sort, perfectly unruffled by Waterhouse's clumsy Yank antics. Waterhouse reaches out and catches a yellow-brown elm leaf that happens to fall through the air before him. He hunkers down, plants his cigarette in his mouth, and, using both hands for steadiness, draws the sawtooth rim of the elm leaf across one of the web's radial strands, which he knows will not have any sticky stuff on it. Like a fiddle bow on a string, the leaf sets up a fairly regular vibration in the web. The spider spins to face it, rotating instantly like a character in a badly spliced movie. Waterhouse is so startled by the speed of the move that he starts back just a bit. Then he draws the leaf across the web again. The spider tenses, feeling the vibrations. Eventually, it returns to its original position and carries on as before, ignoring Waterhouse completely. Spiders can tell from the vibrations what sort of insects they have caught and home in on it. There is a reason why the webs are radial, and the spider plants itself at the convergence of the radii. The strands are an extension of its nervous system. Information propagates down the gossamer and into the spider, where it is processed by some kind of internal Turing machine. Waterhouse has tried many different tricks, but he has never been able to spoof a spider. Not a good omen. The rush hour seems to have ended during Waterhouse's science experiment. He engages Duffel once more. The struggle takes them another 100 yards down the path, which finally empties out into a road just at the point where it is barred by an iron gate slung between stupid obelisks of red brick. The guards are, again, RAF men with Sten guns, and right now they are examining the papers of a man in a canvas greatcoat and goggles who has just ridden up on an army green motorcycle with panniers slung over the rear wheel. The panniers are not especially full, but they have been carefully secured. They contain the ammunition that the girls feed into the chattering teeth of their ravenous weapons. The motorcyclist is waved through and makes an immediate left turn down a narrow lane. Attention falls upon Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse, who, after a suitable exchange of salutes, presents his credentials. He has to choose among his several sets, which he doesn't manage to hide from the guards, but the guards do not seem alarmed or even curious about this, which sets them distinctly apart from most whom Waterhouse has dealt with. Naturally, these men are not on the ultra-mega list, and so it would be a grave breach of security to tell them that he was here on ultra-mega business. They appear to have greeted many other men who can't state their real business, however, and don't bat an eyelash when Lawrence pretends to be one of the naval intelligence liaisons in Hut 4 or Hut 8. Hut 8 is where they decrypt naval Enigma transmissions. Hut 4 accepts the decrypts from Hut 8 and analyzes them. If Waterhouse pretends to be a Hut 4 man, the disguise will not last for long because those fellows have to actually know something about the Navy. He perfectly fits the profile of a Hut 8 man, who need not know anything except pure math. One of the RAF men peruses his papers, then steps into a small guardhouse and stirs the crank on a telephone. Waterhouse stands there awkwardly, marveling at the weapons slung from the shoulders of the RAF men. They are, as far as he can tell, nothing more than steel pipes with a trigger mounted toward one end. A small window cut through the pipe provides a view of a coil spring nested inside. A few handles and fittings, bolted on from place to place, do not make the Sten gun look any less like an ill-conceived high school metal shop project.
Captain Waterhouse, you are to proceed to the mansion, says the guard who had spoken on the telephone. You can't miss it.
Waterhouse walks for about 50 feet and finds that the mansion is, indeed, tragically unmissable. He stands and stares at it for a minute, trying to fathom what the architect had been thinking. It is a busy piece of work, with an excessive number of gables. He can only suppose that the designer wanted to build what was really a large single dwelling, but sought to camouflage it as a line of at least half a dozen wildly mismatched urban row houses, inexplicably crammed together in the middle of 600 acres of Buckinghamshire farmland. The place has been well looked after, but as Waterhouse draws closer, he can see black lianas climbing up the brickwork. The root system that he glimpsed in the underground has spread beneath forest and pasture even to this place, and has begun to throw its neoprene creepers upwards. But this organism is not phototropic. It does not grow towards the light, always questing towards the sun. It is infotropic, and it is spread to this place for the same reason that infotropic humans like Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse and Dr. Alan Matheson Turing have come here, because Bletchley Park has roughly the same situation in the info world as the sun does in the solar system. Armies, nations, prime ministers, presidents, and geniuses fall around it, not in steady planet-like orbits, but in the crazy careening ellipses and hyperbole of comets and stray asteroids. Dr. Rudolf von Hackelhaber can't see Bletchley Park, because it is the second-best-kept secret in the world, after Ultramega. But from his office in Berlin, sifting through dispatches from the Beobachtungsdienst, he can glimpse fragments of those trajectories and dream up hypotheses to explain why they are just so. If the only logical hypothesis is that the Allies have broken Enigma, then Detachment 2702 will have failed. Lawrence displays further credentials and enters between a pair of weathered griffins. The mansion is nicer once you can no longer see its exterior. Its faux row house design provides many opportunities for bay windows, providing sorely needed light. The hall is held up by Gothic arches and pillars made of a conspicuously low grade of brown marble that looks like vitrified sewage. The place is startlingly noisy. There is a rushing, clattering noise, like rabid applause, permeating walls and doors, carried on a draft of hot air with a stingingly oily scent. It is the peculiar scent of electric teletypes, or teleprinters, as the Brits call them. The noise and the heat suggest there must be dozens of them in one of the mansion's lower rooms. Waterhouse climbs a paneled stairway to what the Brits call the first floor, and finds it quieter and cooler. The high panjandrums of Bletchley have their offices here. If the organization is run true to bureaucratic form, Waterhouse will never see this place again once his initial interview is finished. He finds his way to the office of Colonel Chatton, who, Waterhouse's memory jogged by the sight of the name on the door, is the fellow at the top of the chart of Detachment 2702. Chatton rises to shake his hand. He's strawberry blonde, blue-eyed, and probably would be rosy-cheeked if he didn't have such a deep desert tan at the moment. He is wearing a dress uniform. British officers have their uniforms tailor-made. It is the only way to obtain them. Waterhouse is hardly a clothes horse, but he can see at a glance that Chatton's uniform was not thrown together by mummy in a few evenings in front of a flickering coal grate. No, Chatton has himself an honest-to-God tailor somewhere. Yet when he speaks Waterhouse's name, he does not say Wotaheiss like the Broadway Buildings crowd. The R comes through hard and crackling, and the house part is elongated into something like hoos. He has some kind of a wild-ass accent on him, this Chatton. With Chatton is a smaller man in British fatigues, tight at the wrists and ankles, otherwise blousy, a thick khaki flannel that would be intolerably hot if these people couldn't rely on a steady ambient temperature, indoors and out, of about 55 degrees. The overall effect always reminds Waterhouse of Dr. Denton's. This fellow is introduced as Lieutenant Robson, and he is the leader of one of 2702's two squads, the RAF one. He has a bristly mustache, trimmed very short, of silver and auburn whiskers. He is a cheerful sort, at least in the presence of higher ranks, and smiles frequently. His teeth splay out radially from the gum line so that each mandible has the appearance of a coffee can in which a small grenade has been detonated.
"This the fellow we've been waiting for," Chatton says to Robson. "The one we could have used in Algiers."
"Yes," Robson says. "Welcome to Detachment 2701, Captain Waterhouse."
2702, Waterhouse says. Chatton and Robson look ever so mildly startled.
"We can't use 2701 because it is the product of two primes."
"I beg your pardon?" Robson says.
One thing Waterhouse likes about these Brits is that when they don't know what the hell you are talking about, they are at least open to the possibility that it might be their fault.
Robson has the look of a man who has come up through the ranks. A Yank of that type would already be scornful and blustery.
"Which ones?" Chatton says.
That is encouraging. He at least knows what a prime number is. 73 and 37, Waterhouse says. This makes a profound impression on Chatton.
Ah, yes, I see.
He shakes his head.
I shall have to give the proof a good chuffing about this.
Robson has cocked his head far to one side, so that it is almost resting upon the thick woolly beret chucked into his epaulette. He is squinting and has an aghast look about him. His hypothetical Yank counterpart would probably demand, at this point, a complete explanation of prime number theory, and when it was finished, denounce it as horseshit. But Robson just lets it go by.
Am I to understand that we are changing the number of our detachment?
Waterhouse swallows. It seems clear from Robson's reaction that this is going to involve a great deal of busy work for Robson and his men. Weeks of painting and stenciling and of trying to propagate the new number throughout the military bureaucracy. It will be a miserable pain in the ass.
2702 it is, Chatton says breezily.
Unlike Waterhouse, he has no difficulty issuing difficult, unpopular commands.
Right then, I must see to some things. Pleasure making your acquaintance, Captain Waterhouse.
Pleasure's mine. Robson shakes Waterhouse's hand again and excuses himself.
We have a billet for you in one of the huts to the south of the canteen, Chatton says. Bletchley Park is our nominal headquarters, but we anticipate that we'll spend most of our time in those theaters where heaviest use is being made of ultra.
I take it you've been in North Africa, Waterhouse says.
Yes.
Chatton raises his eyebrows, or rather the ridges of skin where his eyebrows are presumably located. The hairs are colorless and transparent, like nylon monofilament line.
Just got out by the skin of our teeth there, I'm afraid.
Had a close shave, did you?
Oh, I don't mean it that way,
Chatton says.
I'm talking about the integrity of the ultra-secret. We are still not sure whether we have survived it, but the proof has done some calculations, suggesting that we may be out of the woods.
The prof is what you call Dr. Turing?
Yes. He recommended you personally, you know.
When the orders came through, I speculated as much.
Turing is presently engaged on at least two other fronts of the information war and could not be part of a happy few.
What happened in North Africa, Colonel Chatton?
It's still happening,
Chatton says bemusedly.
Our marine squad is still in theater. Widening the bell curve.
Widening the bell curve?
Well, you know better than I do that random things typically have a bell-shaped distribution. Heights, for example. Come over to this window, Captain Waterhouse.
Waterhouse joins Chatton at a bay window, where there is a view across acres of what used to be gently undulating farmland. Looking beyond the wooded belt to the uplands miles away, he can see what Bletchley Park probably used to look like. Green fields dotted with clusters of small buildings. But that is not what it looks like now. There is hardly a piece of land within half a mile that has not been recently paved or built upon. Once you get beyond the mansion and its quaint little outbuildings, the park consists of one-story brick structures, nothing more than long corridors with multiple transepts, rows of plus signs, and new ones being added as fast as the masons can slap bricks on mud. Waterhouse wonders, idly, whether Rudy has seen aerial reconnaissance photos of this place and deduced from all of those plus signs the mathematical nature of the enterprise. The tortuous channels between buildings are narrow, and each is made twice as narrow by an 8-foot-high blast wall running down the middle of it, so that the Jerrys will have to spend at least one bomb for each building.
And that building there,
Chatton says, pointing to a small building not far away. A truly wretched-looking brick hovel.
The Turing booms. This boom with an E on the end. They are calculating machines invented by your friend, the Prof.
Are they true universal Turing machines? Waterhouse blurts. He is in the grip of a stunning vision of what Bletchley Park might in fact be. A secret kingdom in which Alan has somehow found the resources needed to realize his great vision. A kingdom ruled not by men, but by information, where humble buildings made of plus signs house universal machines that can be configured to perform any computable operation.
No, Chatton says, with a gentle, sad smile.
Waterhouse exhales for a long time.
Ah.
Perhaps that will come next year, or the next.
Perhaps.
The booms were adapted by Turing and Welchman and others from a design dreamed up by Polish cryptanalysts. They consist of rotating drums that test many possible Enigma keys with great speed. I'm sure the proof will explain it to you, but the point is that they have these vast pegboards in the back, like telephone switchboards. And some of our girls have the job of putting the right pegs into the right holes and wiring the things up every day. Requires good eyesight, careful attention, and height.
Height.
You'll notice that the girls who are assigned to that particular duty are unusually tall. If the Germans were to somehow get their hands on the personnel records for all of the people who work at Bletchley Park and graph their heights on a histogram, they would see a normal bell-shaped curve, representing most of the workers, with an abnormal bump on it, representing the unusual population of tall girls whom we have brought in to work the plug boards.
Yes, I see,
Waterhouse says. And someone like Rudy, Dr. von Heckelhaber, would notice the anomaly and wonder about it.
Precisely, Chatton says. And it would then be the job of Detachment 2702, the Ultra-Mega Group, to plant false information that would throw your friend Rudy off the scent.
Chatton turns away from the window, strolls over to his desk, and opens a large cigarette box, neatly stacked with fresh ammunition. He offers one to Waterhouse with a deft hand gesture, and Waterhouse accepts it, just to be social. As Chatton is giving him a light, he gazes through the flame into Waterhouse's eye and says,
I put it to you now. How would you go about concealing from your friend Rudy that we had a lot of tall girls here?
Assuming that he already had the personnel records?
Yes.
Then it would be too late to conceal anything.
Granted. Let us instead assume that he has some channel of information that is bringing him these records, a few at a time. This channel is still open and functioning. We cannot shut it down. Or perhaps we choose not to shut it down, because even the absence of this channel would tell Rudy something important.
Well, there you go, then, Waterhouse says. We gin up some false personnel records and plant them in the channel. There is a small chalkboard on the wall of Chatton's office. It is a palimpsest, not very well erased. The housekeeping detail here must have a standing order never to clean it, lest something important be lost. As Waterhouse approaches it, he can see older calculations layered atop each other, fading off into the blackness, like transmissions of white light propagating into deep space. He recognizes Alan's handwriting all over the place. It takes a physical effort not to stand there and try to reconstruct Alan's calculations from ghosts lingering on the slate. He draws over them only with reluctance. Waterhouse slashes an abscissa and an ordinate onto the board, then sweeps out a bell-shaped curve. On top of the curve, to the right of the peak, he adds a little bump. The tall girls, he explains. The problem is this notch. He points to the valley between the main peak and the bump. Then he draws a new peak high and wide enough to cover both. We can do that by planting fake personnel records in Rudy's channel, giving heights that are taller than the overall average, but shorter than the bomb girls.
But now you've dug yourself another hole, Chatton says.
He is leaning back in his officer's swivel chair, holding the cigarette in front of his face, regarding Waterhouse through a motionless cloud of smoke. Waterhouse says,
Well, the new curve looks a little better because I filled in that gap, but it's not really bell-shaped. It doesn't tail off right out here at the edges.
Dr. von Heckelhaber will notice that. He'll realize that someone's been tampering with his channel. To prevent that from happening, I would have to plant more fake records, giving some unusually large and small values.
Invent some fake girls who were exceptionally short or tall, Chatton says.
Yes, that would make the curve tail off in the way that it should. Chatton continues to look at him expectantly. Waterhouse says,
So the addition of a small number of what would otherwise be bizarre anomalies make it all look perfectly normal.
As I said, Chatton says,
Our squad is in North Africa. even as we speak, widening the bell curve, making it all look perfectly normal.
Meet.
Okay, so Private First Class Gerald Haught, late of Chicago, Illinois, did not exactly shoot up through the ranks during his 15-year tenure in the United States Army. He did, however, carve a bitchin' loin roast. He was as deft with a boning knife as Bobby Shafto is with a bayonet. And who is to say that a military butcher, by conserving the limited resources of a steer's carcass and by scrupulously observing the mandated sanitary practices, might not save as many lives as a steely-eyed warrior? The military is not just about killing nips, krauts, and dagos. It is also about killing livestock and eating them. Gerald Haught was a frontline warrior who kept his freezer locker as clean as an operating room, and so it is only fitting that he has ended up there. Bobby Shafto makes this little elegy up in his head as he is shivering in the subarctic chill of a formerly French and now U.S. Army meat locker, the size and temperature of Greenland, surrounded by the earthly remains of several herds of cattle and one butcher. He has attended more than a few military funerals during his brief time in the service, and has always been bowled over by the skill of the chaplains in coming up with moving elegies for the departed. He has heard rumors that when the military inducts 4Fs, who are discovered to have brains, it teaches them to type, and assigns them to sit at desks and type these things out, day after day. Nice duty if you can get it. The frozen carcasses dangle from meat hooks in long rows. Bobby Shafto gets tenser and tenser as he works his way up and down the aisles, steeling himself for the bad thing he is about to see. It is almost preferable when your buddy's head suddenly explodes just as he is puffing a cigarette into life. Build up like this can drive you nuts. Finally, he rounds the end of a row and discovers a man slumbering on the floor, locked in embrace with a pork carcass, which he was apparently about to butcher at the time of his death. He has been there for about 12 hours now, and his body temp is hovering around -10 degrees Fahrenheit. Bobby Shafto squares himself to face the body and draws a deep breath of frosty, meat-scented air. He clasps his cyanotic hands in front of his chest in a manner that is both prayerful and good for warming them up.
"Dear Lord,"
he says out loud. His voice does not echo. The carcasses soak it up.
"Forgive this Marine for these his duties, which he is about to perform, and while you are at it, by all means forgive this Marine's superiors, whom you and your infinite wisdom have seen fit to bless him with, and forgive their superiors for getting the whole deal together."
He considers going on at some length, but finally decides that this is no worse than bayoneting nips, and so let's get on with it. He goes to the locked bodies of PFC Gerald Haught and Frosty the Pig and tries to separate them, without success. He squats by them and gives the former a good look. Haught is blonde. His eyes are half-closed, and when Shafto shines a flashlight into the slit, he can see a glint of blue. Haught is a big man, easily 225 in fighting trim, easily 250 now. Life in a military kitchen does not make it easy for a fellow to keep his weight down, or, unfortunately for Haught, his cardiovascular system in any kind of dependable working order. Haught and his uniform were both dry when the heart attack happened, so thank God the fabric is not frozen onto the skin. Shafto is able to cut most of it off with several long strokes of his exquisitely sharpened V-44 gung-ho knife, but the V-44's machete-like 9.5-inch blade is completely inappropriate for close infighting, namely the denuding of the armpits and groin, and he was told to be careful about inflicting scratches, so there he has to break out the USMC Marine Raider stiletto, whose slender, double-edged 7.25-inch blade might have been designed for exactly this sort of procedure, though the fish-shaped handle, which is made of solid metal, begins freezing to the sweaty palm of Shafto's hand after a while. Lieutenant Etheridge is hovering outside the locker's tomb-like door. Shafto barges past him and heads straight for the building's exit, ignoring Etheridge's queries. "Shafto, how about it?" He does not stop until he is out of the shade of the building. The North African sunshine breaks over his body like a washtub of morphine. He closes his eyes and turns his face into it, holds his frozen hands up to cup the warmth and let it trickle down his forearms, drip from his elbows.
"How about it?"
Etheridge says again. Shafto opens his eyes and looks around. The harbor's a blue crescent with miles of sear jetties snaking around each other like diagrams of dance steps. One of them's covered with worn stumps of ancient bastions, and next to it a French battleship lies half-sunk, still piping smoke and steam into the air. All around it, the ships of Operation Torch are unloading shit faster than you can believe. Cargo nets rise from the holds of the transports and splat onto the quays like giant loogies. Longshoremen haul, trucks carry, troops march, French girls smoke Yankee cigarettes, Algerians propose joint ventures. Between those ships and the Army's meat operation up here on this rock is what Bobby Shafto takes to be the city of Algiers. To his discriminating Wisconsin and eye, it does not appear to have been built so much as swept up on the hillside by a tidal wave. A lot of acreage has been devoted to keeping the fucking sun off, so from above, it has a shuttered-up look about it. Lots of red tile, decorated with flowers and Arabs. Looks like a few modern concrete structures, for example, this meat locker, have been thrown up by the French in the wake of some kind of vigorous slum-clearing offensive. Still, there's a lot of slums left to be cleared. Target number one being this human beehive or anthill just off to Shafto's left, the Casbah, they call it. Maybe it's a neighborhood. Maybe it's a single poorly organized building. Has to be seen to be believed. Arabs packed into the place like fraternity pledges into a telephone booth. Shafto turns around and looks again at the meat locker, which is dangerously exposed to enemy air attack here, but no one gives a fuck, because who cares if the Krauts blow up a bunch of meat? Lieutenant Etheridge, almost as desperately sunburned as Bobby Shafto, squints.
Blonde, Shafto says.
Okay.
Blue-eyed.
Good.
Anteater, not mushroom.
Huh?
He's not circumcised, sir.
Excellent. How about the other thing?
One tattoo, sir.
Shafto is enjoying the slow buildup of tension in Etheridge's voice.
Describe the tattoo, Sergeant.
Sir, it is a commonly seen military design, sir, consisting of a heart with a female's name in it.
What is the name, Sergeant?
Etheridge is on the verge of pissing his pants.
Sir, the name inscribed on the tattoo is the following name, Griselda, sir.
Oh.
Lieutenant Etheridge lets loose deep from the diaphragm. Veiled women turn and look. Over in that Casbah, starved-looking, shave-needing ragheads lean out of spindly towers, yodeling out of key. Etheridge shuts up and contents himself with clenching his fists until they go white. When he speaks again, his voice is hushed with emotion.
Battles have hinged on lesser strokes of luck than this one, Sergeant.
Oh, you're telling me, Shafto says. When I was on Guadalcanal, sir, we got trapped in this little cove and pinned down.
I don't want to hear the lizard story, Sergeant.
Sir! Yes, sir!
Once, when Bobby Shafto was still in Oconomowoc, he had to help his brother move a mattress up a stairway and learned new respect for the difficulty of manipulating heavy but floppy objects. Hot, may God have mercy on his soul, is a heavy SOB, and so it is excellent luck that he is frozen solid. After the Mediterranean sun has its way with him, he is sure enough going to be floppy. And then some. All of Shafto's men are down in the detachment's staging area. This is a cave built into a sheer artificial cliff that rises from the Mediterranean just above the docks. These caves go on for miles, and there is a boulevard running over the top of them. But even the approaches to their particular cave have been covered with tents and tarps, so that no one, not even Allied troops, can see what they are up to. Namely, looking for any equipment with 2701 painted on it, painting over the last digit and changing it to 2. The first operation is handled by men with green paint, and the second by men with white or black paint. Shafto picks one man from each color group so that the operation as a whole will not be disrupted. The sun is stunningly powerful here. But in that cavern, with a cool maritime breeze easing through, it's not really that bad. The sharp smell of petroleum distillates comes off of all those warm painted surfaces. To Bobby Shafto, it is a comforting smell, because you can never paint stuff when you're in combat. But the smell also makes him a little tingly, because you frequently paint stuff just before you go into combat. Shafto is about to brief his three hand-picked Marines on what is to come when the private with black paint on his hands, Daniels, looks past him and smirks. "What's the lieutenant looking for now, do you suppose, Sarge?" he says. Shafto and Privates Nathan, green paint, and Bramph, white, look over to see that Etheridge has gotten sidetracked. He is going through the wastebaskets again.
"We have all noticed that Lieutenant Etheridge seems to think it is his mission in life to go through wastebaskets,"
Sergeant Shafto says in a low, authoritative voice.
"He is an Annapolis graduate."
Etheridge straightens up, and in the most accusatory way possible, holds up a fistful of pierced and perforated oak tag.
"Sergeant, would you identify this material?"
"Sir, it is general issue military stencils, sir."
"Sergeant, how many letters are there in the alphabet?"
26, sir,"
responds Shafto crisply. Privates Daniels, Nathan, and Bramph whistle coolly at each other. This Sergeant Shafto is sharp as a tack.
"Now, how many numerals?"
10, sir."
"And of the 36 letters and numerals, how many of them are represented by unused stencils in this wastebasket?"
35, sir. "All except for the numeral 2, which is the only one we need to carry out your orders, sir."
"Have you forgotten the second part of my order, Sergeant?"
"Sir, yes, sir."
No point in lying about it. Officers actually like it when you forget their orders because it reminds them of how much smarter they are than you. It makes them feel needed. "The second part of my order was to take strict measures to leave behind no trace of the changeover."
"Sir, yes, I do remember that now, sir."
Lieutenant Etheridge, who was just a bit huffy at first, has now calmed down quite a bit, which speaks well of him and is duly silently noted by all of the men who have known him for less than 6 hours. He is now speaking calmly and conversationally, like a friendly high school teacher. He is wearing the heavy-rimmed black military eyeglasses known in the trade as RPGs, or rape prevention glasses. They are strapped to his head by a hunk of black elastic. They make him look like a mental retard. "If some enemy agent were to go through the contents of this wastebasket, as enemy agents have been known to do, what would he find?"
"Stencils, sir."
"And if he were to count the numerals and letters, would he notice anything unusual?"
"Sir, all of them would be clean except for the numeral 2s, which would be missing or covered with paint, sir."
Lieutenant Etheridge says nothing for a few minutes, allowing his message to sink in. In reality, no one knows what the fuck he is talking about. The atmosphere becomes tinder-like until finally Sergeant Shafto makes a desperate stab. He turns away from Etheridge and towards the men.
"I want you Marines to get paint on all of those goddamn stencils,"
he barks. The Marines charge the wastebaskets as if they were nip pillboxes, and Lieutenant Etheridge seems mollified. Bobby Shafto, having scored massive points, leads Privates Daniels, Nathan, and Bramph out into the street before Lieutenant Etheridge figures out that he was just guessing. They head for the meat locker up on the ridge, double time. These Marines are all lethal combat veterans, or else they never would have gotten into a mess this bad, trapped on a gratuitously dangerous continent, Africa, surrounded by the enemy, United States Army troops. Still, when they get into that locker and take their first gander at PFC Hot, a hush comes over them. Private Bramph clasps his hands, rubbing them together surreptitiously.
"Dear Lord..."
"Shut up, Private,"
Shafto says.
"I already did that."
"Okay, Sarge."
"Go find a meat saw,"
Shafto says to Private Nathan. The privates all gasp.
"For the fucking pig,"
Shafto clarifies. Then he turns to Private Daniels, who is carrying a featureless bundle, and says,
"Open it up."
The bundle, which was issued by Etheridge to Shafto, turns out to contain a black wetsuit. Nothing GI. Some kind of European model. Shafto unfolds it and examines its various parts while Privates Nathan and Bramph
dismember Frosty the pig with vigorous strokes of an enormous bucksaw. They are all working away silently when a new voice interrupts.
"Dear Lord,"
the voice begins as they all look up to see a man standing nearby, hands clasped prayerfully. His words, sacramentally condensed into an outward and visible cloud of steam, veil his face. His uniform and rank are obscured by an army blanket thrown over his shoulders. He'd look like a camel-riding Holy Land prophet if he were not clean-shaven and wearing rape-prevention glasses.
"God damn it," Shafto says. "I already said a fucking prayer."
"But are we praying for Private Hart or for ourselves?" the man says.
This is a poser. Everything becomes quiet as the meat sauce stops moving. Shafto drops the wetsuit and stands up. Blanket Man's got very short grizzly hair, or maybe that's frost coalescing on his scalp. His ice-colored eyes meet Shafto's through the mile-thick lenses of his RPGs, as if he's really expecting an answer. Shafto takes a step closer and realizes that the man is wearing a clerical collar.
"You tell me, Rev,"
Shafto says. Then he recognizes Blanket Man. He's about to let fly with a lusty, "What in the fuck are you doing here?" But something makes him hold back. The chaplain's eyes make a sideways dart so small and so fast that only Shafto, who's practically rubbing noses with him, could possibly see it. The message being, "Shut up, Bobby. We'll talk later."
"Private Hart is with God now, or wherever people go after they die," says Enoch.
"You can call me Brother Root."
"What kind of an attitude is that? Of course he's with God. Jesus Christ. Wherever they go when they die. What kind of a chaplain are you?"
"I guess I'm a Detachment 2702 kind of chaplain,"
the chaplain says. Lieutenant Enoch Root finally breaks eye contact with Shafto and turns his gaze to where the action is.
"As you were, fellows," he says.
"Looks like bacon tonight, huh?"
The men chuckle nervously and resume sawing. Once they get the pig's carcass disentangled from Hot's, each of the Marines grabs a limb. They carry Hot out into the butcher shop, which has been temporarily evacuated for purposes of this operation, so that Hot's former comrades and shanks will not spread rumors. Hasty evacuation of a butcher shop after one of its workers has been found dead on the floor could spawn a few rumors in and of itself, so the cover story du jour, freshly spun by Lieutenant Etheridge, is that Detachment 2702 is, contrary to all outward appearances, an elite crack medical team concerned that Hot has been struck down by a rare new form of North African food poisoning. Maybe even something deliberately left behind by the French, who are, by accounts, a little irritable about having their battleship sunk. Anyway, the whole shop, the story goes, has to be shut down for the day and gone over with a nit comb. Hot's corpse will be cremated before being sent back to the family, just to make sure that the dreaded affliction does not spread into Chicago, the planetary abattoir capital, where its incalculable consequences could alter the outcome of the war. There is a GI coffin laid out on the floor just to preserve the fiction. Shafto and his men ignore it completely and begin dressing the body, first in an appalling pair of swim trunks, then various components of the wetsuit.
"Hey," Etheridge says, "I thought you were going to do the gloves last."
"Sir, we're doing them first by your leave, sir,"
Bobby Shafto says.
"On account of his fingers, we'll thaw out first, and once that happens, we are screwed, sir."
"Well, slap this on him first," Etheridge says, and hands over a wristwatch.
Shafto hefts it and whistles.
It's a beaut.
A Swiss chronometer in solid uranium, its jewel-laden movement throbbing away like the heartbeat of a small mammal. He swings it on the end of its wristband, made in cunningly joined armor plates. It is heavy enough to stun a muskellunge.
"Nice,"
Shafto says.
"But doesn't tell time too good."
"In the time zone where we are going," Etheridge says, "it does."
The chastened Shafto sets about his work. Meanwhile, Lieutenants Etheridge and Root are making themselves useful. They carry the crudely sawed remains of Frosty the Pig into the butcher shop and throw them on a gigantic scale.
They add up to some 30 kilograms, whatever the fuck that means. Enoch Root, showing an appetite for physical labor that is duly and silently noted by the men, hauls in another pig carcass, stiff as a radio flyer, and dumps it onto the scale, bringing the total up to 70. Etheridge does the breaststroke through clouds of flies to gather up all the cuts of meat that were on the chopping block when the place was evacuated. He throws them on the scale, and the needle swings up to the near 100 mark. From that point, they are able to bring it up to 130 by ferrying hams and roasts in from the freezer one at a time. Enoch Root, who seems to be conversant with exotic systems of measurement, has made a calculation and checked it twice, establishing that the weight of Gerald Hott, converted into kilograms, is 130. All the meat goes into the coffin. Etheridge slams the lid shut, trapping some flies who have no idea what they are in for. Root goes around with a claw hammer, driving in 16 penny nails with sure, powerful Carpenter of Nazareth-like strokes. Meanwhile, Etheridge has taken a GI manual out of his briefcase. Shafto is close enough to read the title, printed in block letters on his olive drab cover. Coffin Sealing Procedures. Part 3. Tropical Environments. Volume 2. High Disease Risk Situations. Bubonic Plague, etc. The two lieutenants devote a good hour to following the instructions in that manual. The instructions are not that complicated, but Enoch Root keeps noticing syntactical ambiguities and wants to explore their ramifications. First, this rattles Etheridge, then his emotions tend towards impatience, and finally, extreme pragmatism. To make the chaplain shut up, Etheridge confiscates the manual and starts Root on stenciling Hott's name on the coffin and pasting it up with red stickers printed with medical warnings so appalling that the topic headings alone induce faint nausea. By the time Root is finished, the only person who can legally open this coffin is General George C. Marshall himself, and even he would have to first get special permission from the Surgeon General and evacuate all living things within a 100-mile radius.
"Chaplain talks kind of funny," says Private Nathan at one point, listening, slack-jawed, to one of these Root-Etheridge debates.
"Yeah,"
exclaims Private Branff, as if the accent took a really keen listener to notice.
"What kind of an accent is that, anyway?"
All eyes turn to Bobby Shafto, who pretends to listen for a bit and then says,
"Well, fellas, I would guess that this Enoch Root is the offspring of a long line of Dutch and possibly German missionaries in the South Sea Islands, interbred with Aussies. And furthermore, I would guess that being as how he grew up in territories controlled by the British, that he carries a British passport and was drafted into their military when the war started, and is now part of ANZAC."
"Ha!"
roars Private Daniels.
"If you got all of that right, I'll give you $5. Deal," Shafto says.
Etheridge and Root finish sealing the coffin at about the same time Shafto and his Marines are wrestling the last bits of the wetsuit into place. It takes a shitload of talcum powder, but they get it done. Etheridge supplies them with the talcum powder, which is not GI talc. It is from somewhere in Europe. Some of the letters on the label have pairs of dots over them, which Shafto knows to be a characteristic of the German language. A truck backs up to the loading dock, smelling of fresh paint. It is a detachment 2702 truck. In go the sealed coffin and the now vulcanized dead butcher.
"I'm going to stay behind and check the wastebaskets," Lieutenant Etheridge tells Shafto. "I'll meet you at the airfield in 1 hour.
Shafto imagines 1 hour in the back of a hot truck with this cargo.
"You want me to keep him on ice, sir?"
he asks. Etheridge has to think about this one for a while. He sucks his teeth, checks his watch, hems and haws. But when he finally answers, he sounds definite.
"Negative. It is imperative for purposes of this mission that we now get him into a thawed mode."
PFC Gerald Hott and his meat-laden coffin occupy the center of the truck's bed. The Marines sit to the sides, arranged like pallbearers. Shafto finds himself staring across the carnage into the face of Enoch Root, which is wearing an expression of forced nonchalance. Shafto knows he ought to wait, but he just can't stand it.
"What are you doing here?"
he finally says.
"The detachment is relocating," the rev says. "Closer to the front."
"We just got off the fucking boat,"
Shafto says.
Of course we're going closer to the goddamn front. We can't go any farther unless we swim.
As long as we're pulling up stakes, Root says coolly, I'll be coming along for the ride.
I don't mean that, Bobby Shafto says. I mean, why should the detachment have a chaplain?
You know the military, Root says. Every unit has to have one.
It's bad luck.
It's bad luck to have a chaplain? Why?
It means the waffle butts are expecting a lot of funerals is why.
So you are taking the position that the only thing a cleric can do is to preside over funerals. Interesting.
And weddings and baptisms, Shafto says.
All of the other Marines chortle.
Could it be you're feeling a little anxious about the unusual nature of Detachment 2702's first mission?
Root inquires, casting a significant glance at the late Hot, then staring directly into Shafto's eyes.
Anxious? Listen, Rev, I've done some things on Guadalcanal that make this thing look like Emily fucking Post.
All of the other Marines think this is a great line. But Root is undeterred.
Did you know why you were doing those things on Guadalcanal?
Sure, to stay alive.
You know why you're doing this?
Fuck no.
Doesn't that irritate you a little bit? Or are you too much of a stupid jawhead to care?
Well, you kind of backed me into a corner there, Rev,
Shafto says. After a pause, he goes on.
I'll admit to being a little curious.
If there was someone in Detachment 2702 who could help answer your questions about why, would that be useful?
I guess so,
Shafto grumbles.
It just seems weird to have a chaplain.
Why does it seem weird?
Because of what kind of unit this is.
What kind of unit is it?
Root asks. He asks it with a certain sadistic pleasure.
We're not supposed to talk about it,
Shafto says.
And anyway, we don't know.
Down the hill, immense zigzagging ramps descend pompously over rows of tiger-striped arches to the strand of ramifying railway lines that feed the port from the south.
It's like standing in the drain of a fucking pinball machine,
says B. Shafto, looking up at the way they have just come, thinking about what might come rolling down out of the Casbah. They head south along those railway lines and come into a zone of ore dumps and coal heaps and smokestacks, clearly recognizable to Great Lakes Eagle Scout Shafto, but here operated through some kind of cross-cultured gear train about a million meshings deep. They pull up in front of the Société Algérienne d'Éclairage et de Force, a double smokestacked behemoth with the biggest coal pile of all. They're in the middle of nowhere, but it's obvious that they are expected. Here, as everywhere else that Detachment 2702 goes, a strange rank inflation effect is taking place. The coffin is carried into the SAEF by two lieutenants, a captain, and a major, overseen by a colonel. There is not a single enlisted man in sight, and Bobby Shafto, a mere sergeant, worries about what sort of work they'll find for him. There is also a paperwork negation effect going on here. Whenever Shafto expects to be stalled by the usual half an hour's worth of red tape, an anxious officer runs up and waves his hands furiously, and he is allowed to proceed. An Arab, wearing what appears to be a red coffee can on his head, hauls an iron door open. Flames lunge at him, and he beats them back with a blackened iron stick. The pallbearers center the head of the coffin in the opening, and then shove it through, like ramming a big shell home into a 16-inch gun, and the man with the can on his head clangs the door shut, a tassel on the top of his can whipping around crazily. Before he's even got it latched, he's yodeling just like those guys up in the Casbah. The officers all stand around agreeing with each other and signing their names on clipboards. So, with a dearth of complications that can only strike combat veteran Bobby Shafto as eerie, the truck leaves the Société Algérienne d'Éclairage et de Force behind, and heads back up those damn ramps into Algiers. The climb's steep, a first gear project all the way. Vendors with pushcarts loaded with boiling oil are not only keeping up with them, but cooking fritters along the way. Three-legged dogs run and fight underneath the actual drivetrain of the truck. Detachment 2702 is also dogged by coffee can-wearing natives threatening to play guitars made of jerry cans and by orange vendors and snake charmers, and a few blue-eyed burnous wearers holding up lumps of unwrapped and unlabeled dark stuff. Like hailstones, these may be classified by analogy to fruits and sporting goods. Typically, they range from grape to baseball. At one point, the chaplain impulsively trades a Hershey bar for a golf ball of the stuff.
"What is that, chocolate?"
Bobby Shafto asks.
"If it was chocolate," Root says, "that guy wouldn't have taken a Hershey bar for it."
Shafto shrugs.
"Unless it's shitty chocolate."
"Or shit," blurts Private Nathan, provoking incredible hilarity.
"You heard of Mary Jane?"
Root asks. Shafto, role model, leader of men, stifles the impulse to say,
"Heard of her? I've fucked her."
"This is the concentrated essence," says Enoch Root.
"How would you know, Rev?"
says Private Daniels. The Rev is not rattled.
"I'm the God guy here, right? I know the religious angle."
"Yes, sir."
"Well, at one time, there was a group of Muslims called the Hashishin who would eat this stuff and then go out and kill people. They were so good at it, they became famous or infamous. Over time, the pronunciation of the name has changed. We know them as assassins."
There is an appropriately respectful silence. Finally, Sergeant Shafto says,
"What the hell are we waiting for?"
They eat some. Shafto, being the highest-ranking enlisted man present, eats more than the others. Nothing happens.
"Only person I feel like assassinating is that guy who sold it to us," he says.
The airfield, 11 miles out of town, is busier than it was ever intended to be. This is a nice grape and olive growing land, but Stony Mountains are visible farther inland, and beyond them is a patch of sand the size of the United States, most of which seems to be airborne and headed their way. Countless airplanes, predominantly Dakota transports, a.k.a. Goonie Birds, stir up vast, tongue-coating, booger-nucleating dust clouds. It doesn't occur to Shafto for quite some time that his dry eyes and mouth may not be entirely the result of dust in the air. His saliva has the consistency of tile adhesive. The detachment is so damn secret that no one at the airfield even knows that they exist. There are a lot of Brits here, and in the desert, Brits wear shorts, which makes Shafto want to punch them in the nose. He controls the urge. But his obvious hostility towards men in short pants, combined with the fact that he is demanding to be pointed in the direction of a unit that is so secret that he cannot specify by name or even vaguely describe it, leads to a lot of bafflement, a lot of incredulity, and generally gets the Anglo-American alliance off on the wrong foot. Sergeant Shafto, however, now understands that anything to do with the detachment is liable to be way off to one side, shrouded in black tarps and awnings. Like any other military unit, Detachment 2702 is rich in some supplies and poor in others. But they do appear to control about 50% of last year's total U.S. tarpage production. When Shafto mentions this fact and goes on about it to his comrades at great length, some of the men look at him a little funny. It's left to Enoch Root to say,
"Between the giant lizards and the black tops, some people might think you were acting a little paranoid."
"Let me tell you about paranoid,"
Shafto says. And he does, not forgetting to mention Lieutenant Etheridge and his wastebaskets. By the time he's had his say, the whole detachment has assembled on the far side of those tarps, and everyone is nice and tense, except for their newest recruit, who, as Shafto notes approvingly, is beginning to relax. Lying on the bed of the truck in his wetsuit, he adjusts rather than bounces when they go over bumps. Even so, he is still stiff enough to simplify the problem of getting him out of the truck and into their assigned Goonie Bird, a bare-knuckled variant of the DC-3, militarized and, to Shafto's skeptical eye, rendered somewhat less than airworthy by a pair of immense cargo doors gouged into one side, nearly cutting the airframe in half. This particular Dakota has been flying around in the fucking desert so long that all the paint's been sandblasted off its propeller blades, the engine cowling, and the leading edges of the wings, leaving burnished metal that will make an inviting silver gleam for any Luftwaffe pilots within 300 miles. Worse, diverse antennas sprout from the skin of the fuselage, mostly around the cockpit. Not just whip antennas, but great big damn barbecue grills that make Shafto wish he had a hacksaw. They are eerily like the ones that Shafto humped down the stairway from Station Alpha in Shanghai, a memory that has somehow gotten all mangled together now with the other images in his head. When he tries to recollect it, all he can see is a bloodied Jesus carrying a high-frequency dual-band dipole down a stone staircase in Manila, and he knows that can't be right. Though they are on the precincts of a busy airfield, Etheridge refuses to let this operation go forward when there is as much as a single airplane in the sky. Finally, he says, "Okay, now!" In the truck, they lift the body up, just in time to hear Etheridge shout, "No, wait!" At which point they put him down again. Long after it has stopped being grimly amusing, they put a tarp on Gerald Hodd and get him carried on board, and shortly thereafter are airborne. Detachment 2702 is headed for a rendezvous with Rommel.